bowls and some of the stuff, didn't there? There was a pool room somewhere. I can't remember where it was because I didn't play pool. But there was that as well. And, of course, the non-members bar where people would drink. And because members, you know, didn't have decent offices and stuff, people basically went out of their office to socialise. And that helped. I think that helped communication in the building and helped people mix across parties. Whereas in the new building, because the offices are so good and they've got decent fridges and, you know, you can invite people in and have drinks, you can have 30 or 40 people in your office in this building, you know, three or four and you're crammed against the wall.
Mm. Yeah.
But they were the main sort of sporting, social activities, I think.
What about after hours? Was there like a social scene with your colleagues?
Well, what happened, a lot of the staffers used to go to Manuka or Kingston, which they still do now in the new building. But groups of staffers, you know, you tend to make friends with different people, so there'd be people going to restaurants. I didn't do that a lot because I had married at home and a young daughter, so I tended on. But occasionally we'd go, and quite often with McPhee, I'd go to lunches at Kingston or Manuka, and it'd be a fascinating array of people at that sort of thing. But a lot of the staffers did go to restaurants. I mean, the lobby restaurant was used pretty heavily, and restaurants, something. And yeah, there were lots of informal parties in the press gallery and in offices and in corridors. And a lot of the committee rooms and meeting rooms were used for functions. And there's always lots of visitors. And quite often they'd put on, you know, coffee, tea, or they'd put on grog and snacks and things like that. But there was a lot of social activity. I would think there's probably more here than there was in the new building, even though there's probably a lot more people now, so be different.
I meant to ask earlier, what was your actual title? Like, what was your job designation?
Public service had a name for it, I can't remember, some sort of administrative secretary or something like that, but it was basically just a staffer for Ian McPhee. That was basically the title. And he was entitled to three or four staff, and I was one of those.
And were you happy with the salary you were earning?
Oh, I took a cut in pay from being a teacher, but the overtime, you know, you were given pretty good overtime and allowances, so that made up for it. But certainly the salary wasn't anything, and that wasn't the reason I did it by any means. I was earning less than when I was teaching. I mean, the only decent money really in political staffers really is if you go into government, you know. I think they're a lot better now. I mean, shadow minister staffers probably get paid pretty substantial too, but in those days it was pretty paltry.
Where would you eat?
Quite often we'd go to just the staff dining room or cafeteria. I'd bring my own lunch. Usually I'd just have lunch in the office. But a lot of times you go to restaurants. But it was just so ad hoc, you just weren't sure when you could do it and all that sort of thing. But quite often McPhee would take us to the members, or the, you know, the part of the members' dining room where you could take visitors. So we went there quite a bit.
I wanted to ask about the technologies too in the office and the building generally as it applied to you, you know, as you used it. Were there changes in those few years you were here?
We had a fairly new computer system, but it was pretty rudimentary compared to what we've got now, but there was no email, no internet. So you basically had a word processing computer, so it was good for writing things. Because in the old days, you'd tend to, there was a typing pool. And the typing pool still existed back then, and they were housed over in the Hotel Currajong, where there were some workers in Parliament House who were at the Hotel Currajong, and I actually ended up working there later on. But there was still a typing pool, so members and senators could get things typed up by this typing pool. But we had word processing facilities in office, but pretty basic. And you still did a lot of things just handwritten. We had access to photocopiers and printers. But I think, look back now, it was fairly primitive compared to what it is now. The phone system was okay. I mean, we had pretty reasonable phones. But that was it. You basically had a phone and a computer and a typewriter.
And with the advent of computers, did you have training for that?
No, there were courses, I think, but you probably wouldn't have time to go to them anyway. But we were, when there was still a typewriter in the office, which was used. I didn't use it a lot, but we still had a typewriter. And the word processing was starting to take off, so the computers were okay for that. So you could type up a decent letter and type up documents that, you know, need to be circulated to people. But yeah, some, you know, a lot of members were still using the typing pool. They were handwriting stuff out, sending it to the typing pool, and then that was their copy.
You mentioned to me before the interview the pranks that occurred in the building, because I'm fascinated to know what were these pranks.
Oh, well, there was lots of things went on, and I mean, I probably can't mention names, but there were things like, there was one particular shadow minister who had responsibility for parts of infrastructure, and he actually was renowned for practical jokes himself. And anyway, one of the other shadow ministers I happened to be in on this meeting said, well, we'll play one on him. So anyway, he'd been to a conference, it was either in the Northern Territory or Tassie, doesn't matter anyway, but he'd been at this conference, and it was to do with infrastructure development, all this sort of stuff. Anyway, this shadow minister said, look, I'll fix him. So what he did, he started writing letters to this shadow minister, and he dodged up the letterhead somehow, and he signed this letter Bruce. Now, the assumption was it was one of the other backbenchers. And in this letter, the backbencher writes to this shadow minister and says, I think you're doing a wonderful job. However, I'm really disappointed that you haven't mentioned any infrastructure developments for my particular electorate. And he listed a series of things that he thought should be done. He thinks, you know, as a Liberal shadow minister, I think it's really important that you look after the rural regions, and you should do this, this and this. Anyway, he sent a couple of letters along this line, and he kept patting him on the back, saying how good he was and all this sort of stuff. And anyway, there was some bill come into the House, and these letters kept going to the shadow minister, and he was wondering who was writing these damn letters, because Bruce was just a pseudonym. And something came up, and the guy who set the prank up said, I think we should listen to what he's going to say in Parliament today. So anyway, the shadow minister gets up and he lays it on really thick about how it's really important that all this infrastructure go into this particular part of this particular electorate, and I'm really concerned about this and blah, blah. He went on and on and on about how he was going to make sure that all this policy, and it was all just a setup. It was all just set up. So he assumed it was real, and it was all just a joke. So that sort of thing's going on all the time.
Did you then let him know that it had been a
joke? No, they never knew that. And this was set up because this particular person also did lots of practical jokes. But there was another one where it was two National Party members, I think. And again, this was another Liberal shadow minister. And the leader at the time was Ian Sinclair, leader of the Nationals, and I think I would probably say it. There was another member who didn't like Sinclair one little bit. He was a National as well. And anyway, this guy used to rant and rave about how he didn't like Sinclair. So anyway, this shadow minister, I don't know how he did it. He got some letterhead from this particular backbencher's office, and he sent an invitation to Sinclair to come around for drinks to this guy's office. So there's a whole series of, you know, a group of us who knew this was happening. So he sends this letter around saying, let's let bygones be bygones. Come round, I'll shout your drinks, let's kiss and make up and we'll forget the past and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, this is out in the annex, I think. We're all hovering around, hiding behind photocopies and office doors and all this sort of stuff. And at this set time, sure enough, Ian Sinclair marches up the corridor and he's got something in his hand, and he would look quite happy and whatever. He knocks on the door, staffer opens the door, and he ushers him in, and next minute, yeah, what the bloody hell are you doing here? And he basically, you know, threw him out of the office. And we were all just laughing and laughing and laughing. It was all just complete setup, you know. And I don't think either of them knew what happened. Okay. And no one ever said anything, you know.
So there wasn't any investigation?
Oh, no, no. I don't think that it didn't go any further. It wasn't a big deal or anything, but both of them, I think, were pretty perplexed about just what had gone on, you know. But, you know, that sort of stuff went on. It was an interesting time.
How common was that kind of practical joking?
Well, I saw it happen a number of times, but, you know, that obviously was happening in other parts of the building that I wouldn't have known about, and I'm sure other parties and other groupings in the building were doing a similar thing. But, yeah, there were some good practical jokers around.
I mean, back then it used to be common, I think, in workplaces of any kind.
Yeah, well, I think nowadays it's a bit harder to do because if you offend someone's dignity or whatever, you can get in all sorts of trouble. I mean, those sort of... And I mean, some of those things probably, I think they were innocent enough, but, you know, some pranks that were played on men and women and all that sort of stuff were probably inappropriate, but, you know, you don't want to see all of it thrown away. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a bit of levity in life.
Now, let's talk about Ian McPhee. With these interviews, we're always keen to try to get to understand the parliamentarians in terms of their personalities and their... characters. Would you like to talk about Ian McPhee and that?
Well,
as you experienced
it? The first thing I'd say about him, he was a decent human being. I mean, he was always good to his staff. All the staff who worked for him liked him. He was a bit of a softie, you know, he liked kids and he was good with people. He was always interested to meet other people and get different ideas. He wasn't closed. I mean, he had set policy ideas. So he was a decent human being. I reckon that was the best way to sum him up. The problem was, while I was there, that was the Howard Peacock thing was just so time-consuming, and he was a key player in that. He was the sort of unofficial leader of the Wets, and there was about 12 in a little group that I think they set up in early 86 called Liberal Forum. And this Liberal Forum was basically set up as a bit of a counter to the move of the New Right. So you basically had the two streams, and Howard was representing, not totally, but to a large extent, the economic drives and some of the New Right. The New Right were not happy with Howard either in a lot of ways. I didn't think he was radical enough. And Peacock was, he was more a small L liberal and much more liberal than Howard was. And McPhee was probably more intellectual. Peacock was... bit of froth and bubble, really, and most people will say that. Peacock was a good people person, Howard wasn't. Howard was more of a policy person, Peacock wasn't. McPhee had a bit more depth, and he was interested in policy genuinely, whereas Peacock was just totally, I think, consumed by the leadership thing. But McPhee was involved with that heavily, so that detracted from a lot from what he should have been doing or what he could have been doing. And I think his view was, until they could sort the leadership out, and he really wanted Peacock because he knew the sort of policies he wanted, he'd have more influence and more chance with Peacock. And Peacock and McPhee did get on pretty well together, whereas McPhee and Howard, well, they just didn't get on, basically. They differed on so many policy areas. So McPhee was distracted by that lot, and so his little Liberal Forum included people like Alan Misson, Senator Alan Misson from Victoria, and unfortunately he died, I think, in early 86, Senator Chris Pulick, Philip Ruddock, Senator Robert Hill, Maxie Burr from Tasmania, Steele Hall to an extent. They're probably the main ones, and they were sort of fighting a rearguard action from the push from groups like the National Farmers Federation, people like Costello, Kroger in Victoria, who were trying to push the party to become economically dry, into privatisation, tougher on refugees, you know, not very sympathetic to things like feminism. They thought that was all a bit esoteric. Whereas McPhee was more into, he and Malcolm Fraser got on very well, and they agreed on things like multiculturalism, refugees, feminism, fair go for Aboriginals, and you know, all that stuff. So from about early 83, when I wasn't there, but through to about 90, the Liberal Party was pretty well distracted by the Howard Peacock thing. It went that long. And so, you know, there were aspects of policy development like going on, but it was all overshadowed by Peacock Howard. And McPhee was trying to, I think he spread himself too thin. And if he had a weakness, I think, I mean, I used to say to him quite a lot, he used to invite people in so he could talk to them about policy and all about the leadership and whatever. I said, you have to get out and mix more with particularly the people that you haven't got. And he was a bit hesitant to do that, or he didn't get time to do it, I'm not sure. But so he was concentrating on this little group, and Peacock needed those votes. So, you know, and Howard knew those people were Peacock supporters. So it was a, you know, there was a lot of animosity in the party at the time.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, and I've always said, I think the greatest enemies in politics are within the same party.
Yep.
And you can see it now with Gillard Rudd, you can see it with Hawke Keating, certainly Howard Peacock, and some of the best friendships in politics are across parties.
Did McPhee ever display any animosity to other people?
Well, I mean, I heard him say some, you know, when people disappointed him or people, the things that he strongly disagreed with. But he wasn't a hater in the traditional sense. He was a genuine person. He liked people, but he really was worried the way the party it was going. He was more that old Deaconite liberal tradition, and he could see the party being hijacked, heading in the wrong direction, and Howard was one of them. But there were lots of outside influences on it. I mean, I heard him say some disparaging things about people, but I mean, in politics, people say all sorts of things in the heat of the moment, but I wouldn't say he wasn't a nasty person by any means. I did meet some who were very nasty. You know, good haters and never forgave, never forgot. He wasn't one of those.
How would he address you and how would you address him? Oh,
very informal, that's what I liked about him. It was first name basis all the time. And the other thing I liked about him, I mean, he held nothing back. There were no confidences. I mean, a lot of politicians didn't trust their staff. With Ian McPhee, what you saw was what you got, and he'd tell me the most intricate things happening in his family. He'd come out of a meeting with the Prime Minister and he'd tell me what was going on. Not all the time. Shadow Cabinet, he'd tell us what was going on. His view was we needed to know, so if we had to make decisions, we know it with more knowledge. There were some things he didn't tell me, obviously, but, you know, it was... I remember one night I dropped him off at the lodge. He didn't want to take a comm car, and he spent... how many hours with Hawke, talking over all sorts of things. He implicitly trusted me with that. I mean, a lot of other people wouldn't even say anything about that. He and Hawke were quite good friends, talked a lot on the phone, but they had a falling out, and I'm not sure that that's ever been resolved. And they didn't speak to each other for a long time. I don't know whether that's still the case or not, but...
Did having that kind of inside information ever put you in a position where you could have been compromised? I mean, I'm thinking of journalists trying to obtain information from you. Did you?
Not really. I mean, I knew the information. I had to be very careful and what I said. So I always was very careful in it. You know, some of the things McPhee told me, I knew you just don't mention to anyone other than maybe other staff or someone he trusts. But he was very trusting. But I'm not aware of any situation where any of his staff let him down. I mean, they were all loyal. And all the staffers I met, including ex-ones, were all loyal to him. And some other, I know other shadow ministers and other members told their staff virtually nothing. You know, but he was the complete opposite. So, you know, there were lots of things that went on that you just had to keep secret. And,
I used the wrong word there when I said compromised. I was really asking about whether journalists tried to obtain information that they might have assumed that you had.
Well, journalists might ask you, you know, what was discussed or what was decided at Shadow Cabinet. You say, well, you know, that stuff's not available until it's publicly available. There's nothing I can say about it. Or you just say, well, I don't know anything about it anyway. But yeah, they'd try things on. But yeah, not to my knowledge at any stage there were there any problems with, if he was really open with his staff, I don't think it ever came back to bite him at any stage.
Anything else you'd like to say about Ian McPhee as a person?
Well, it was just interesting at the time, and it was sort of highlighted just how divisive the party was. I mean, he'd been a senior minister in the Fraser government, whatever. At the time I was here, McPhee's best friends were in the Labor Party. He was really good friends with Hawke. He was good friends with Ralph Willis. He was very good friends with Mick Young. He was good friends with John Button. He was good friends with Barry Jones. Now, those people were the sort of people he would talk to, have meals with. Even the minister, his opposite minister, Michael Duffy. Duffy and McPhee were good friends and spoke a lot together. Now, obviously, they talked about things that were happening in their own party or whatever, but I don't think McPhee ever compromised or ratted on his own party or anything, but he was genuinely interested in other people and whatever. And he found people like Mick Young and Barry Jones and all them really interesting people to know. And he socialised with them to an extent. A lot of it was done privately, but that happened a lot in the building. And his friends in the Liberal Party were people like Robert Hill and Chris Pulick and Alan Misson, people like that. But there were a lot of people in the Liberal Party, and he was good friends with some of the old, what I call the old style nationals, the old traditional politicians, people like Clary Miller, Skinny Robinson, I forget the names of some of the other ones, Ralph Hunt. Now, these are all the old style 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s politicians compared to a lot of the new modern, you know, flash dressing, mobile phone carrying party people. These were the old style ones that don't happen, don't exist anymore. And McPhee got on well with those too, but he did. There were a lot of people in the Liberal Party that he was uncomfortable with.
You mentioned to me when I asked before the interview in the questionnaire, you know, were there individuals who kind of stood out in your memory or stand out? You mentioned Andrew Peacock, Mick Young and Ian Cameron.
Mm. Well, other ones, I mean, the dominant ones were obviously Keating and Hawke, you know, just around their dominance of politics in the building. But, yeah, some of the real characters, I mean, Mick Young, he could just tell stories all night, you know. He was an ex-shearer, great with people, you know. I don't think I ever heard anyone say anything bad about Mick Young. Even when he got caught up in a scandal later on with the Ivanov affair. Everyone just liked Mick Young, and McPhee got on well with him. But, you know, you could sit down and times McPhee would take us to a meal somewhere and there'd be Mick Young there and Barry Jones and Duffy and, you know, all sorts of people would walk past and you'd have Robert Hill there or some of those other people. And Mick Young could just tell stories all night. You know, he's a real character. And a lot of those sort of people. I mean, the likes of Jim Killen, he was there too. McPhee wasn't a big fan of his, but, I mean, he was a bit of a character with some of the speeches he made. And Freddie Daly, I think he was just still here then. Ian Cameron was an interesting one, the member for Maranoa. Mm-hmm. Particularly at night after he'd had a few after-dinner drinks. He was quite a character, but he was always stirring up Hawke, and you know he was a bit like Wilson Tuckey, but a little bit different. But you knew if you went to a meeting or anything where if Ian Cameron turned up, he was a backbencher. If he turned up, he'd certainly liven things up. If you know McPhee might have a meeting with some officials from communications companies or whatever, and a briefing for backbenchers, you'd know if Ian Cameron came in. The things that get livened up, you know, he was so direct, so open, you know, he said what he thought, a bit like Tucky.
Okay. What about the prime ministers? Like, did you, or former prime ministers, did you meet McMahon or Gorton?
I met Gorton one time. I was with McPhee somewhere, I can't remember, but John Gorton actually walked past and they had a good conversation and I met him briefly then. Malcolm Fraser visited occasionally, and he and McPhee were still good friends. They spoke a lot on the phone. So he came to the office a couple of times and I'd met him. Hawke I didn't meet, but, you know, he'd ring on the phone occasionally and want to talk to McPhee. So they were the main, I think they were the other ones, yeah.
And with Fraser, how did he, can you say anything about how he struck you as a person, you know?
Well, I think he was like his public image. He was fairly aloof. I never had the opinion that Fraser was good with people, you know, like a Hawke was. I think Fraser was always a bit uncomfortable with people, and even after years in public office, I think he was still the same. So he always came across to me, well, I only met him once or twice briefly, and he was interested to talk to McPhee, so hard to get out an impression. But I always felt he had the impression of being aloof. I think that was just the way he was. He wasn't a natural, just like Howard, particularly in the early days, wasn't natural with people, whereas Peacock was. Hawke was a natural with people. Fraser wasn't. You know, they have to work hard to, with the people skills.
You've touched on the leadership tensions and that battle, Howard, Peacock. Anything you'd like to elaborate on? Would you like to say more about that?
Well, I mean, it was just a shame that the wasted years, but it does show up if you're disunited. It's really hard to be elected now. In July 87, Howard should have been Prime Minister. I mean, the polls were in his favour early in that year. Apart from the ongoing leadership tension you had at the last minute, the J for Canberra. Now, the J for Canberra thing had been bubbling along a bit behind the scenes for quite a few months. And I never really understood it, neither did McPhee. It just didn't make sense. The money that was supposedly behind Joe wasn't there. And we'd spoken to people who had contact in Queensland or came from Queensland. They knew the money wasn't there. I mean, the Joe for Canberra people were talking 25, 30 million to get him and his candidates and get him into Parliament. That wasn't there. The whole thing was just a shimmer. It was, Joe just virtually couldn't be stopped. Even Sir Robert Sparks was opposed to it right from the start, and he was the national president in Queensland, very wealthy, and he helped bankroll Joe. Even he was opposed to it at the start. He thought it was crazy. But the National Farmers Federation were pretty dominant, the new right push, all those people. And Joe, really believed his own publicity, I think. He was popular in Queensland, but he wasn't popular across the rest of Australia. But that push, and Joe, set out to humiliate Howard and Peacock. And unfortunately, I don't know why, but Peacock actually got involved on the sidelines of the Joe for Push Canberra. He was actually meeting with some of the Joe for Canberra pushers. So ironically, you had Joe blackguarding Howard and Sinclair. Sinclair and Joe just, and the National Party was split then, the same as the Liberals. So you had not only the Liberal split, you had the National split. And ironically, you had Joe blackguarding Howard, saying, he's no good, I'm going to become Prime Minister. And he was supporting Peacock. And he opposed everything Peacock stood for on small-L liberalism. But he thought Peacock was a better, and the deal was, I think, that Peacock was going to be Deputy Prime Minister and Joe was going to be Prime Minister, which was never going to happen. But you had all this, so the Queensland Nationals completely split away from the New South Wales Nationals, where most of the members were. And Ian Sinclair, he wasn't a very good leader anyway, he couldn't pull all this together, or he tried to counteract the Joe for Canberra thing, but the National Party split. And for the first time in a long time at the 87 election, the Liberal and the National Parties weren't a coalition. Now, if that Joe for Canberra push hadn't happened, I think even with that Howard Peacock thing, an election coming up, they would have won it. the Joe for Canberra things what wrecked it. And that was just, it was like a bolt from the blue. You know, Joe thought he was the Messiah. He had people patting him on the back, and a lot of it was Gold Coast property money. You know, the so-called White Shoe Brigade, which I think John Moore came up with that term. So the big money, people like Mike Gore, and there were a couple of others. He set up Sanctuary Cove, I think, in Queensland. That they had this big push, and they thought they could impose Joe on the rest of the country. And it just showed just the lack of political nous these people had. And unfortunately, Howard couldn't counter it. Sinclair certainly was out of his depth. He didn't know how to deal with it. And so you had the national split, Liberal split. And Hawke called an early election, took advantage of it. Very rare to have an election in winter. Hawke did it, and he won it. And he stayed there until 96. Labor stayed in.
Did McPhee ever talk about Joe in the office? Like, terms would he speak of him?
Well, there were lots of meetings. He had meetings with journalists and lots of meetings with, other people, other politicians. And, I mean, I think they were all just could not believe that anyone was taking this Joe for Canberra thing seriously. But the downside of it was, I don't think anyone really believed Joe was going to become Prime Minister. But the problem was the damage it was causing, the media publicity that was happening, and the fact the Nationals were ripping each other apart. Joe threatened to disendorse all Queensland Nationals, federal members, if they didn't support him. All the New South Wales Nationals, basically, I think most of them stuck with Sinclair. So you had a Queensland, New South Wales, which is where most of them come from. You have this huge split, and that was the worry to all. The people that were talking about it, like McPhee and Peacock and all those, it was the damage that was being done. I don't think any of the people that had any political nous at all, I don't think they genuinely believed Joe was going to do it. I mean, he just didn't have that support in the South. He was a Queensland phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And whatever way you looked at it, the money wasn't there. There were a lot of promises, but the money wasn't there, and he wasn't saleable to the rest of the country. It wasn't going to happen. But it was the damage that he did to the coalition. And that enabled Hawke. And Hawke was a superb political strategist. He knew what to do. He knew politics well. And he was a much more effective leader than Hawke, Howard, Peacock, Keating. Hawke was a really good political operator and saw his chance and won the election.
And what led to you deciding to move on from McPhee's staff?
Well, because Howard and McPhee just did not get on, and McPhee got demoted. When Howard became leader in late 85, he took over from Peacock. McPhee was shifted from industrial relations to communications because McPhee believed in conciliation and arbitration and the so-called old industrial relations club, they called it. Whereas Howard was more up for freeing it all up, which is in fact what's happened, but you've still got that fight back. You know, there's still elements of the old system there anyway, but Howard McPhee just did not see eye to eye on industrial relations, so that was a huge issue for them. Howard accused McPhee of leaking stuff, and there was a lot of animosity, and McPhee made speeches opposing the takeover there on Weekly Times by Murdoch, and Howard wasn't opposed to it. All sorts of things they disagreed on. And in the end, and I remember McPhee saying to me, look, I'm impregnable, I've got, you know, support in the party. I said, well, you can't always guarantee that. I mean, don't back on that. Howard could get a strong leadership moment. And he did. I think it was in April 86. He demoted, well, he actually sacked Peacock first, then he got rid of McPhee. So Peacock went to the backbench, McPhee went to the backbench, and Senator Peter Boehm resigned over an issue to do with affirmative action, I think. And McPhee almost resigned then as well. But anyway, Howard sacked him. As a result of that sacking, McPhee had to lose one staff member. I put my hand up and said, I'd had enough by then anyway. I mean, it was crazy life. And I mean, I'd seen politics up close, but I could just see these so-called professional politicians just going around in circles and fighting amongst themselves. It was really frustrating. Mm-hmm. I liked McPhee, but it was just frustrating. I'd had enough. A couple of the staff in Melbourne volunteered to go, and I said, no, I was ready to go. So as a result of that, but I was allowed to stay until the election, so I didn't go until after the election. So I stayed there and campaigned and whatever. But that's the reason, because McPhee was dumped from the shadow ministry.
Were you still the only staff member here for McPhee at that stage?
Basically, yeah. And if the sittings was on, there was at least one or two others came up. But I was still basically on my own here. When the election campaign was on, we basically shut up shop here. I went to Melbourne for a week or two and, you know, letterboxed and campaigned down there and did stuff like that. So, you know, we were walking around suburbs stuffing letterboxes for a week or so. Yeah.
Well, did that job have any impact on your family life? You mentioned you had a daughter, was it?
Yeah, I had a daughter, Penny, who was born in 80. No, what year was she born? She must have been born after that. It was just after the election. But Marion was pregnant, I think. But I just remember being tired all the time, and I didn't have much time with my wife. So it was quite wearing, and even on weekends and that, you didn't know